Good evening, everyone. My name is Don Gates, an alcoholic. I instantly apologize to those who drove interminable miles believing that they were going to hear a messianic message. There is really no one who can replace Clancy. In all sincerity, he is the finest speaker that I have heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. But as we say down at the office, judge not, lest ye be judged. I was asked on a very short notice, and ordinarily it would have been impossible. I have a few commitments, but this particular weekend was open, and apparently my higher power doesn't approve of that. And when I heard that he also had smitten Clancy, I thought there must be a message there somewhere. See, I have been speaking in Alcoholics Anonymous, drunk and sober, for 31 years. And I know Clancy. In fact, Bill's wife, Janet, was telling me earlier that in one of Clancy's first journeys through here, it had been arranged, or at least they had wanted to arrange for him to stay at her house. And she had been so overawed looking at her humble bedroom that she thought this would not be appropriate for a celebrity. And I assured her that I had known Clancy when he had no teeth and was sleeping in the back of a car outside the 6300 Club, and he would be delighted to be in her house. Now, Clancy, I don't know what you folks think of Clancy out here, but in California we do. And I attribute a good measure of my own sobriety to him, because I was not one who came in and instantly mounted the 12 golden steps to eternal sobriety. In fact, we were talking about that previously, how when Bill asked me how long I'd been sober now, and I didn't know. I had to kind of figure it out, because in the early days in AA, I used to actually keep track of such things. In fact, I counted my birthdays. One, two, one, two, one, two. And I had to go back and do a count and realize that this would be 23 years now this year. Because it's astonishing, truly, how long you can stay sober if you don't drink. And Bill and several others were boasting about the fact that they had not seen it necessary to go out, that they had allowed others to do their experimentation for them. And I told them that I am proud to say I never asked anyone to do anything I wasn't willing to do myself. But Clancy contributed to my sobriety, because if you leave AA for any length of time, things change. In one of my early periods, I used to do a wonderful story about the Eskimo, and people in Los Angeles referred to Don's Eskimo story. Now, I went out for a couple of beers, When I came back, they were talking about Bobby Earle's Eskimo story. And I was a little hurt by that, because that was my story. I had read it in the Reader's Digest, and it was mine. But even worse, and probably one of the primary reasons I am sober today, is that I had met Clancy, as I say, when he came to Los Angeles, and I took a spot inventory of him, and I realized that here was one who had gone too far. He would never make the program. I went out for a couple of beers, when I came back, there was a small sect that had formed, and he was leading them. And they were touching the hem of his garment for individual healing. And I made a vow at that moment I had best never drink again. No telling what would happen on the next excursion. But those of you who know Clancy can't doubt for a moment that all of us admire the work that he does. He works with people that I can't communicate with at all. In fact, I think I'm probably the one that you may have heard him mention in his talks. When I would get a newcomer that was so far gone, so weird and strange, that not only didn't I know an answer for his questions, I had no idea what his question meant. When they were that bad, I used to put them in my car and in the middle of the night drop them at Clancy's front door and run. And after he had gotten down and worked with them in the muck and mire for 2 or 3 or 4 years, and they had matured and become sufficiently perspicacious that they could see through him, then I would take them back and convert them into gentlemen. So I owe a great debt to Clancy. I also attended his meeting out there when I returned this last time, and I think some of that enthusiasm helped me to get back with it. But I had a very difficult time when I first came around it. You know, it's strange. You must never confuse glibness with sincerity. You know, I attended my first meeting at the Beverly Hills Men's Stag, and that's a short pitch meeting. They just point the finger and everyone gets up and does 5 minutes. And I had never been, not only that, the reason I was there was a little odd. I had arrived in Los Angeles and I was looking for work, and I called this attorney, and he said he knew about my past, and he suggested that, yes, we might get together and talk, and he said, I will meet you at 8:30 at Roxbury Park in Beverly Hills. And I thought that was a rather strange place for two men to get together to talk business, but I knew in Hollywood they were like that, some of them, and I went to this park at 8:30 at night, and it was an AA meeting. And as I say, it was this short pitch, point the finger type meeting. And I was absolutely fascinated by it, because they were the greatest bunch of people I had ever run into in my life. Chuck Chamberlain was then about 5 or 6 years sober, and Jack Bailey, a newcomer, a few years sobriety, and these were the most profoundly witty, clever, funny, entertaining people I had ever heard in my life. And I'm chameleon-like. See, I take on the coloring of any environment in which you drop me. You put me in jail, and I look around, and I see hard as the shtick here. and I instantly become a regular.
But off, screw.
Utterly terrified someone's going to put the arm on me, but I can fit in. And so by the time 10 o'clock rolled around, I knew what AA was all about. I'd been there for the better part of an hour and a half, and I saw that here humility was the gig. And I can out-humble any clown in the house when I put my mind to it. And so, would you believe it? Just before the meeting, they ran out of the regulars, and the leader looked down and he said, "I don't think we've heard from the young man with the shiny black hair." That was your humble servant 31 years ago. And he said, "Would you mind coming up and putting a close to it for us?" Well, as I say, I'd been in AA now for an hour and a half. So I got up and I knew what the message was. I gave him a few jokes. I gave him a little touch of pathos. I ended on a rising note of hope. And I sat down to the closest thing to a standing ovation they'd had in the men's SAG. And they swarmed around me, and one of them came up and said, "I'm leading a meeting next, whatever day it was, at the Arroyo Seco. Have you spoken there recently?" Well, I had just drunk my way down from San Francisco with a brief stop off for some undergraduate work at a mental hospital. I had no idea what the Arroyo Seco was, so I was reasonably certain I hadn't spoken there. And I said, "No, I don't believe I have." And he said, "Well, I'm leading next whatever day it was. Would you mind being my main speaker?" And I said, "Certainly, always glad to help the poor devil crushed by the juggernaut demon rum." Now, at that time, they used to ask for a showing of hands of anyone in their first, second, or third meeting. And I couldn't raise my hand because I felt it might hurt the image and make it difficult for the newcomer. But I gave them, this time, about 45, 50 minutes of humor, pathos, and then once again, I ended on a soaring note of hope. And if you can make two people laugh, you get two invitations. And I got two invitations. Within 6 months, my calendar was filled. I was speaking every night of the week. I stayed sober that first year on applause and the novelty of a solid bowel movement. It is amazing, you people who are made of sterner stuff giggle about that. He jests at scars who never felt a wound. But if you had had the fever that I had during the war and that suffered from that malady, it wouldn't be such a source of merriment. I mean, every time I drank, it happened to me. You know, they talk about a weak stomach. I could run into the John in the morning not knowing which end to point. I would splatter two walls simultaneously. My first spiritual experience was a solid bowel movement. That the novelty of that alone should give you one birthday cake. But if you do not move beyond that into the program itself, that isn't going to be enough. I mean, even applause and grunting in the morning will become boring. And so I was naturally taken drunk. And people would try to help me, and they would say, "Don, you have to get more active." And I would become active, and I would drag them in off the bar stools, ready or not. Still had trouble. And they said, "You must get into self-analysis. Find out your character defects." And I would don hip boots, take rod and reel, and go up my stream of consciousness looking for shortcomings and character defects. And I still had trouble. And then they said, "You must become more spiritual." And so I would pursue God up and down the byways of the San Fernando Valley, and I still had trouble. And then, as I say, about 23 years ago, I decided to quit drinking. Haven't had any trouble since. You see, this is why it is, to a degree, awkward if you have continued to speak throughout. By the way, I never stopped speaking during this period. You know, I felt I owed it to the newcomer. I would sober up and make any pitches that were on my calendar. So don't confuse glibness with sincerity. In fact, I wish you heard, apparently a number of my tapes are floating around this area because a couple of people came up and told me things about myself my mother doesn't know. But I wish you could hear a tape. I heard one just the other day of a pitch I gave before my last flip. My God, it was inspirational. I mean, the insight that was there for all of us. I discussed our Jungian indebtedness, our Freudian overtones. I traced AA through the Oxford movement and Bill James. I mean, it was a truly, if I could have just stopped sucking on the jug, it would have been a miracle in our time. There's no question about it. And now, having been sober as long as I have, I don't know those things anymore. I was sitting here, he actually, Barney the well-beloved, came up and asked me about the tape. I tried to get into a discussion of royalties, but he just wanted to know how long I was going to talk. And I said, "Well, it depends. If I limit myself to what I know, maybe 5 minutes." Because it's true. When I first came around, alcoholism seemed like such a mysterious and strange disorder. I was certainly convinced that I suffered from odd maladies for which science had neither cure nor even name. And now that I have been around a while, it seems to me alcoholism is the simplest disorder ever to have afflicted mankind, the most easily recognizable, identifiable, and treatable. You know, the very name gives you such a marked clue as to what the problem is. Now, sincerely, if you were not handicapped with a degree in psychology and someone came up to you and said, "What do you think causes alcoholism?" I would wager you would come up with the correct surmise instantly. Alcohol. Right. See, but if, on the other hand, you have been educated beyond your intelligence, it's quite possible that you will, as some of our non-alcoholic brethren do, you will guess things like foul training, lack of self-esteem in childhood, failure to close an Oedipus triangle, the decline of petty bourgeois capitalism, lingering resentment from the Civil War. In Los Angeles, someone even suggested it might be due to smog. It drives people into the bars, you know, their eyes hurt and they... See, and yet it must be evident that if alcohol had never been invented, there wouldn't be one alcoholic classifiable or identifiable as such on the face of the earth. The only reason that it is difficult for us, as well as the non-alcoholic, to grasp the nature of our problem is that only one person in ten has that phenomenon. The one thing that distinguishes us from the non-alcoholic, at least according to our book, and that is what? The phenomenon of craving that results from taking the first drink. No, other than that, we're no different than anyone else. But as to that, it leads to the confusion. You know, I was thinking about it. I think I mentioned it. I noticed a couple of people here smoke. In fact, I happened to walk outside, and I, before the meeting started, that whole front, the steps, the grass, everything was filled with people smoking. It looked like Hollywood High. except I didn't see any brown hand-rolled ones, but I smoked. For 35 years, I smoked 2 to 3 packs of Camels a day. And I finally got a mantra to repeat, emphysema. but in my smoking years, no one ever came up to me and asked me the idiotic questions that they asked me about my drinking. Now, I would assume it's true with you. Has anyone ever came up to you and said, "Why did you start smoking? Was it a feeling of inadequacy? A hole in your tummy through which wind blew?" I mean, nobody ever asked a dumb question like that, because we all know why we started smoking. It was because we wanted to look like big shots, mature, manly, and so on. If you were from the era I was, look at any movie made during the 30s, 40s. Everyone smoked. Everyone. It was the thing to do. John Wayne, Humphrey Bogart. Paul Henry lit 2 at once and got laid. And a woman who smoked could do anything. I mean, that's why we started smoking, and nothing mysterious about it. And yet, why do they ask us such dumb things about our alcoholism? It's only because 1 in 10 who drink get hooked. But with cigarettes, everyone who smokes for any period of time, a few weeks really, certainly a month or so at the outside, you're hooked. And once you're hooked, nobody thinks it's mysterious. Have you ever anybody come up to you and say, "Don, I just noticed it. 10:30 in the morning, and you already have a cigarette." Do you take a cigarette when you get up in the morning? Do you smoke alone? You frequently seem to smoke all during the day. I mean, of course they don't ask things like that, because that's understandable. You know, sometimes, you know, isn't it amazing, really? We smoke because we're hooked. We drink because we're hooked. When we get ready to stop either one, we will do it. It's no big thing. But until then, it's impossible. You know, sometimes the non-alcoholic will say of us in regard to our drinking, "Yes, you alcoholics, you're lacking in willpower." That is the most absurd canard I have ever heard. You know why they say that? They think we want to get sober. If they had any idea what our true goal was, they would stand in awestruck wonder at our dedication. what do they have in their lives that they will pursue to the gates of insanity or death? And it is because we are physically different that these weird problems arise. It was very important for me to focus on that. Because if I thought that alcoholism had something to do with my discipline, my willpower, my steadfastness, my determination, I'd still be out there. Because I'm a very disciplined person. And when I realized that it had nothing to do with those things, that it was strictly physical, then for the first time, I think, I began to understand what this program was about. Your emotions, your neuroses, your psychoses even, really have nothing to do with your alcoholism. It's a physical condition. Since they were handing out chips, I know there are probably some newcomers here wondering if they're really alcoholic. As if their opinion meant a damn. You know, in other words, what difference does it make what someone thinks about his diabetes? Would the view of a man who had hemorrhoids, if he could get into a position to view them, would his view be of any relevance? You know, of course not. You either have it or you don't. It's that simple, and what you think about it is beside the point. Oh, I mean, it determines how you're going to die, whether in the gutter, chewing your tongue, despised by everybody who had the misfortune to come into contact with you, or after a relatively contented and fruitful life. But that's probably something that doesn't mean a whole heck of a lot, except to each of us. See, we don't endanger Western civilization, the alcoholic. Even at our fullest flower, we don't endanger society. We're not that well organized. It's the non-alcoholics that are the curse out there. You know, by the way, if anyone here who's wondering if they're alcoholic, you have a certain way of finding out. Just ask yourself one question and be candid in your response, and you'll know without doubt. If you have any doubt, ask yourself this: am I now, or have I ever been, in attendance at an AA meeting? There's your answer. In the history of our organization, we've never had a non-alcoholic come in here and ask himself that sort of a question. Why? What would a non-alcoholic come in here for? It would be like a virgin going in for a rabbit test. I mean, it's... you know, patently absurd. So if you're here, you're an alcoholic. People say you're not supposed to tell a newcomer that, but what are they going to do, kick you out? If there are any newcomers here who are sharp as I was when I got here, they have more drinking to do anyhow. They might as well take a good message to jail with them. By the way, I don't mean to imply that people don't come in for varying reasons. Better living through chemistry being what it is today, there probably is no such thing as a pure alcoholic over age 40. I'm 41. But there really isn't. Can you imagine, when you were drinking, can you imagine an alcoholic at the height of his powers? And someone comes up and says, try one of these, hit one of these, toke some of this. You think we'd really say, no, thank you, I'm killing myself with this. You know, of course not. If they'd have offered it to me, I'd have taken it. It just wasn't available. Never heard of it. Half of it hadn't even been invented, but that which wasn't available in my crowd. In fact, I like the old gag that goes, in my generation, all we knew was that allegedly Spanish Fly was an upper and Saltpeter was a downer. But in Hollywood now, in the whole Los Angeles area, there's a tendency for people to get up and give that hyphenated identification. You know, I am an alcoholic and an addict. You know, as if they're saying two different things. It's like someone getting up and saying, I live in Atlanta, in the state of Georgia. You know, what do you think an alcoholic is? I'm quite sure. I'm sure there can be addicts who are perhaps not alcoholics, but there are no alcoholics who aren't going to be addicts. So what do you think it is we're consuming? Of course, it gets kind of strange out there, but they do that for a while, and then they drop the secondary part usually. But I was in a meeting the other day in Hollywood, a real crazy meeting, a lot of real crazy meetings in Hollywood, but this one was called Anything Goes or some such. And the people got up and identified themselves not merely with a hyphenated description, but they actually named their chemical of preference. You'd almost be a pharmacologist to follow some of them. But it turned into sort of a boasting contest. You know, can you top this? And finally, a very affluent young woman, you could tell she was moneyed because she was dressed like a tramp. No one would possibly go on the street attired like that unless they were moneyed. And she got up and said in a haughty tone, I'm only into freebase cocaine. You know, and my heart just rushed out to her. You know, I thought, the poor dear, she will never know a week's run on Muscatel. Such specialization. It's like a koala bear. They run out of eucalyptus and they've had it. I suppose I don't go into what I used to be like in large measure because it doesn't really tell you what I was like if I describe the things that happened to me. The things that occurred while I was drinking were not me. You know, I hear speakers get up and say, I can't blame the things I did whilst drinking on the booze. And I always think, poor pathetic devils. It must be terrible. I can. I blame virtually every rotten thing that happened to me when I was drinking on booze. I didn't plan it. I heard a guy speak just the other night. He talked about getting out of his car on the Hollywood freeway when it was moving, as if he did it on purpose, you know. If I were to tell you the things that happened to me, that wouldn't tell you what I was like. I never even planned to be an alcoholic. I never walked into some counselor's office and said, I think I'd like to major in vomiting. Perhaps with a minor in diarrhea. I never planned an evening the way it went. Never. Did you really plan your evening? I never said to myself, well, let's see, it's Friday night, what do we do? Got about a pint here in the house, I think I'll kill that and then go out and total the car. I've just canceled the insurance to save money. That'll be a good start. Perhaps on the way to the hospital, the ambulance attendant will roll me, and I'll have no identification. I'll spend 24 hours being humiliated down at General. But I'll be able to get out Sunday. I can cuff a jug on the way home, and I can terrorize the wife and children all day Sunday afternoon. Yeah, I mean, was it not manifest from the moment I arose that I was far too sophisticated or urbane to do a thing like that? But it happened to me. And that was the thing, was that I think early on, one of the reasons, in fact, several people, guests who heard this tape came up asking, You know, it's an odd thing. You can tell a simple message from the heart, as I usually do, that would be capable of constructing a life on. And instead, people come up and ask me to tell some sordid tale of weakness. That's all they remember. It's an odd thing. A story, apparently, that I told on these tapes, it was meaningful to me at one time. I just won't talk about it anymore, but it was meaningful to me at one time because it was the first instance I'd had where something occurred that I couldn't blame others for. Because ordinarily, when you come into conflict with society, whether drunk or sober, you have to have the help of some other member of society. And you can blame it on him. I mean, that's what we say in the judiciary. Put the blame where it belongs, on somebody else. And, you know, and so I would say, well, if he hadn't have made a left turn, I wouldn't have hit him. Which was true, but if I hadn't have been bombed out of my gourd, I might have seen he was making the left turn a block earlier, you know, an unguided missile coming down the street there. Or if he hadn't have said what he said about our president, I wouldn't have a broken nose. Which again was true, but if I had been smashed, he might not have made his point so tellingly. But I always was able to blame it on someone else until this one incident came along, which, as I say, several people asked me to describe. And as a preface, I might say that I drank primarily to relax. And on this particular occasion, I'd been relaxed about 5 days. And I awakened in the middle of the night out of a horrible dream of hellfire, sulfur, imps, Dante's Inferno, hellfire. I was just drenched with perspiration, and I staggered to my feet and, you know, kind of lurched around trying to get my bearings, wondering what was wrong with me. I thought it might even have something to do with my drinking. Until I realized that I had I'd nodded off in the front room, my family having retired at some earlier hour to wherever it is they went, and I had nodded off on this couch, and I could tell that because there was a thin spire of smoke coming up from it, from a little hole near where my head had been, and I, being a man of quick judgment, saw what was the problem. I had either had a cigarette in my hand or mouth, and it had fallen onto the plastic covering of this couch, burned its way through into the matting, where, not having sufficient oxygen to take fire, it had slowly formed embers that had spread in the course of the evening over the full length of the couch. So there was nothing wrong with my drinking, which I was relieved to discover. I had simply been barbecued. And commending myself on this insight, I went into the kitchen, got a pitcher of water, came back, and tried to pour it into that little hole, achieving but a rather spectacular cascade onto the rug. So I knew more dramatic measures were called for, and I went into the kitchen, came back the next time with a butcher knife, and I slashed that couch open from one end to the other, and then drenched the coals with the cooling balm of the water, and it subdued them, as I had anticipated, but it also filled the room with acrid black smoke. And this was, 40 years ago. And I can still remember standing there, you know, my eyes watering, looking down at this slashed and sodden mass, and knowing that almost to a certainty my wife was going to notice it. She was a very keen-eyed woman. Now, there was little that passed her ken around that house, I'll tell you. And though she was a good and kindly loving woman who would never say anything intentionally to hurt or demean her husband, I mean, she didn't want to in any way denigrate my manhood, but on the other hand, sometimes in moments of pique and exasperation, she would say things that were cruel. Hurtful, even. You know, like she might say, "You drunken SOB, you did it again, didn't you?" and she didn't use just the prefixes either. And then she would have great remorse at having done this, and I wanted to spare her this. So I thought, what'll I do? Well, the only thing that occurred to me was to get the couch out of there. I mean, she might vaguely remember there had been something on that side of the room, but the only thing is it isn't really easy to be moving furniture after you've been relaxed for 5 days. But with that Herculean strength that comes only to the panic-stricken, I somehow managed to roll it, heft that couch onto my shoulders. I headed out through the front door. We lived on the second floor of a rather small apartment that had a tiny balcony with columns. I remember I almost beat myself to death trying to make the turn, you know, caroming off those poles. Bung, 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 bung. But I finally got down into the patio, and then I realized foresight was a little vain here. It is virtually impossible to conceal a bed couch in a typical apartment patio. And I hadn't thought about what I was going to do with it after I got there. So I'm standing there. I should be in a hospital. Instead, I'm holding a couch. Legs quivering. And I remembered a creek about 5 miles away. And so I lurched to my car and I threw this couch up on top of it. And then got in and proceeded to drive to this selected place of repose. And all I wanted in life was dignity. I didn't really object to disaster one heck of a lot as long as I could face it with dignity. But by this time, it was 6:30, 7 in the morning, I guess. It was daylight out anyhow, and there were people on the bus stops with lunch pails and briefcases. I really have no idea how they can stay up that late, but they're out there. And as I drove down the street, I noticed that their heads turned to follow me. Their eyes wide, jaws agape. And I thought, my gosh, it doesn't take much to draw a crowd in California. Until I chanced to pass in front of an auto sales room in which they had a dusty window that acted like a mirror. And I got the vision of what it was these people were looking at. Here is a fellow with a week's growth of beard, nattily attired in a bathrobe. He's driving his car down the street, on top of which sits a couch, which previously had lacked sufficient oxygen to take flame, but now moving down the street, the air was going through it like a billows, and the flames were 30, 40 feet in the air. Ultimately returned, I found it impossible to think of some way to blame that on my sleeping wife and children whose lives I had imperiled. Later, however, I was to move beyond social drinking. The thing, of course, as I indicated earlier, the problem I had was that until I got it into my depths of my soul, as it were, that Alcoholism was a physical problem, and no amount of analysis, willpower, was going to do anything about it. I was doomed. Now, the solution to your alcoholism as such is no problem. Simply quit drinking. No big deal about that. I've known alcoholics who just had the physical allergy. I remember I was working on the railroad one occasion, and there under Rule G, if you're drunk on the job, you're subject to immediate termination, so it said. And it was a holiday, and actually I had a bottle, so I offered the fellow a drink. And he said, no thanks. I thought, uh-oh, what have I run into here? Company sink. And I said, look, fellow, I want you to take a drink. He said, oh, don't worry about it. And no, don't worry about me. Go right ahead. He said, it was just that I tried it when I was younger. I didn't know what was going to happen. Some nights there was nothing, nothing happened. But other nights I just went wild and did the awfulest things. And I said, listen, fella, I asked you a fair question. That happens to me all the time. Now, why won't you take a drink? If all you had was the physical allergy, would you really continue to pursue it? Can you imagine going back and repeating anything if it did you what booze does to you? Occasionally you'll hear a newcomer will say, I enjoyed the taste of a good bourbon. God, I don't think they've reflected on that. You know, you might sell a can of near beer, but can you imagine selling non-alcoholic bourbon? Remember what it was like that first drink. Now, I'm not talking about the sixth or seventh when you could drink horse urine and it wouldn't matter. I got that first drink of hot raw whiskey, particularly in a car with your head down so the police didn't see you, you know. if that's all, when I remember my first drink, if someone had come up to me, as they did when I was 15 years old and offered me a drink, but if they'd have explained it to me, if they'd have said, Don, here's a pale amber elixir. It's called whiskey. Take a drink of it. I want to tell you in advance, it tastes like fire. It's the most wretched thing you can consume and stay alive. You'll never feel cheated because it's going to take the lining right off your larynx. It's going to clear your esophagus all the way down. It's going to hit your stomach with a nauseating splash. See, because it's a toxic substance. That's where we get the word intoxicated. Toxic means poisonous. It's poisonous. It is going to hit the stomach, and it'll just shudder because your body's going to want to throw it back up again. But if and it does. Remember that first thing, it'll make you shake like this? Involuntarily, like a dog or like a man leaving a urinal. You know, like, whoosh. But, Don, if you can just keep it down, then you'll be able to pour a whole lot more on top of it, and you'll get the dry heaves and diarrhea. I don't like to think I would continue to do that. So I had something else. And that's why we're gathered tonight, is that we probably have something else or we would have quit drinking years ago. We have an obsession. Now, that's not a mental illness. That's not a psychiatric disorder. What is it described? Read like the Chinese water torture at every meeting was read here tonight. The great obsession of the alcoholic is what? The illusion that somehow, someday, he's going to control and enjoy his drinking. And that sends us back again. You don't have to be mentally ill to be an alcoholic. There's no impediment. In fact, if you're really psychotic and are able to stay sober, you'll probably become a guru and lead many people. But it has nothing to do with that. Our book says there are people on our program under every hue on the emotional spectrum. We haven't had 10 guys walk on the face of the moon yet. One of them's already in AA. They check their people pretty close. They're not wired right. They don't shoot them up. 1 out of 10 of everybody is going to be an alcoholic. It's an equal opportunity destroyer. It doesn't care anything about who we are, what we are. So we have to do something about this obsession. And we do that by using those steps. Well, we have a book in the chapter in our book which has a caption about as subtle as alcoholism. Chapter 5 has the caption, How It Works. Now, the intellectual may miss that for months. They even number the steps to help the intellectual understand the sequence. And if you take them, it's just like a mass production. It's like Henry Ford's mass production. Long before there were AA, people would be stricken in individual instances. If you've ever read William James, Our Godfather, and his Varieties of Religious Experience, a lot of those people they were talking about in there, St. Augustine, Mark Antony, a lot of them, they were roisterers in the grapes. They were alcoholics, and something happened to them and changed their lives. But very, very rarely. AA, in essence, they set out to manufacture spiritual experiences, just like Henry Ford and his production line. You start off at step one, and you keep adding things, and you go down the line, and from this mass of non-functioning steel, out rolls an automobile. And it works. It always does. There's nothing unique about it. I was mentioning to somebody else, I was reading a philosopher the other night, and astounded to discover how he had plagiarized AA over 2,000 years ago. It's amazing. The only thing is that we have to do it. It's the same thing that the non-alcoholic world recommends unto itself. I have never read a saint, a sage, an elder of the village who didn't recommend exactly the same things if you would live a happy life. They're all the same. What's so unique about it? Honesty? I never heard anybody recommend dishonesty as a way of life. I never heard anybody said, I'm going to build my life four square on the rock of chicanery and deceit. Everybody's in favor of honesty. Making amends? Who isn't in favor of having amends made to them? there's nothing unique about it. It's simply that we have to do it. The non-alcoholic doesn't. They can go through their entire life clinging to those dubious luxuries of resentment and self-pity that we have to abandon. Not because we want to. We're just like the non-alcoholic. We're not going to give up a lifetime of failure without a struggle. But we have to. They don't. They don't. I watch them downtown where I work. They walk around their knuckles like their jaws tense. I'm going to get even, by God. I'm going to pay back. Got to look out for number one. I'm going to get that bitch on the stand, make her admit she's an unfit mother right in front of the children. And they're crazy. Sometimes people refer to the non-alcoholic world as if they had well-adjusted lives. If you think the non-alcoholic world has looked upon the universe and gathered careful empirical data, applied logical analysis to it, and then drawn conclusions on which they function to their own best interest, you have not been outdoors in a long time. The non-alcoholic world is stark, raven, lunatic, mad. AA is a little series of islands in a sea of lunacy, because we say proudly and correctly that we are a spiritual organization, not a religion. But sometimes we almost imply that religions are not spiritual, which must come as a shock, to some of the church members. Even the Catholic Church has been struggling along a little while before we got here. Pope had a spiritual experience. I understand he still goes to Mass. I don't know. But the thing is, they don't have to follow it. We get together, and we have no rules, no regulations, no bylaws, no credos, no loyalty oaths, and yet we function almost with total harmony compared to the way the outside world functions. Now look at Ireland with two great religious sects, boom, kill. Look at the Sons of the Prophet over in Iran and Iraq, slaughter, killed by the hundreds. Look at poor little bleeding Beirut. Dozens of religious movements. We come in here, all dictators with inferiority complexes, and we almost never engage in homicidal assault. And it isn't that we don't gossip and backbite and say strange things. We're very, very human. We have feet of clay extending up to our ears at times. And I'm a loud mouth. I know that I have people who are not happy with me, but I don't believe there's a single person in Alcoholics Anonymous who wants to see me drunk. Literally, I mean that. I don't think No matter how much I've offended by being a flowery mouth, fatuous fart sometimes, and I hate being called fatuous, I don't think there's a single person in AA who, if I called them in the middle of the night wanting to stay sober, wouldn't help me. No one wants to see me get drunk. Dead, certainly. I'll grant you. So we have to do it, and they don't. And if we do it, of course, it works. It allows us to live the sort of a life that everyone should live. Your emotional barometer gets down below the spell of storm where that obsession doesn't take over again. It's a good life. I know this from very new people because of the chips. I don't want to frighten you off by letting you think it's all happiness. Yeah, no newcomer ever came in looking for comfort, joy, and peace of mind. We come in looking for explanation for failure and justification and cause for complaint. But you can learn to live with happiness. It isn't as bad as it seems at first blush. Even comfort and contentment is not too unendurable. But I don't want to take away the newcomer's hope entirely. There are also going to be moments of pain and anguish beyond anything you have presently experienced. You are going to know pain that is going to curl your hair on this program. Because the world, it is the old world, yes. People are going to do what people do. They will reject you, they will abandon you, they will turn on you, they will not recognize your virtues. They will die. You will become ill. All the things that are flesh or air to are going to continue to happen. The universe isn't going to rise up on its tippy toes because you stopped drinking. No two-legged beast who ever got out of the forest has avoided unhappiness. You're going to have it too. But you just stand still, and you can no longer change the subject by getting drunk. And the pain is exquisite. It's unendurable sometimes. It seems like you're in a seam of pain. No doors. I mean, a cell of pain without a seam is a better description, and there's just no way out. And you just stand there and hurt and work your steps. And what happens? Suddenly, it seems like that barrier disappears, and you have what is known as a spiritual experience. Mine didn't come until I've been sober over 10 years. But it does come, and it would be avoided if you backed away from it. You have to go through it. But most of the time, it's going to be very, very, very pleasant. As someone was telling me about one of my tapes, to me, AA is a place to live. It doesn't, in a sense, have anything to do with avoiding pleasure, avoiding fun. This is what it's all about. This is where life starts. Life is now in session. If you are an alcoholic, up until this moment, if there's a moment of your sobriety, booze controls you. It told you what you were going to do. It planned your days, your destinies. It controlled your every action. Now we're free. We can do anything we want. And it can get extremely exciting. If you want it to be so, if you will be willing, without chemical courage, to go out there and live. Because this world is so filled with extraordinary things. I have had kind of a wild and exuberant sobriety because I want to live. And this is what it may not even be that my program has improved so much over the years. It may be simply that I'm aging. I don't have that much time left. You know, and what is the worst thing that can happen to someone who comes on this program and tries it? They'll be sober, in full possession of their faculties, the balance of their days. You know, and that's not such a bad thing. As far as we know, we only get one trip on this little blue-white globe we call the Earth, only one go-round. And if you were to take our allotted 70 years and multiply it by 365, you'd come up with a relatively small number, something like 25,000 something. If someone were to give you $25,000 and say you were to make it last, I really doubt you'd wad it up by the handful, throw it down the toilet, and flush it away. Now, you can get money back, but you can't get a day back. Days are priceless. They can never be replaced. And I gave up those days by not the handful, but by the armload, the weeks, the months, sodden, stuporous, drunk, or sick, hungover, wretched, wishing I could but die, or locked up like an animal because I'd made a mess of myself and society was going to rub my nose in it. I hate those lost days. I want to know now what is going on, and I want to experience everything that happens from this point on. There's not that many left. One of my kids said to me, that youth is awful. He said, Dad, if I should ever die, what do you mean, yes, punk? It's not a hypothesis, it's reality. I'm looking at it. I've given up the thought of suicide. How much time would I save? Of course, by the way, I don't mean to say there's no sacrifice in that condition of sobriety, because you won't be able to be hip and slick and cool anymore. You won't be able to say, hey, what's happening? I mean, hell, you'll know. But it's about life. A friend of mine came around who blew 13 years. Been sober 13 years and blew it and finally got back, and they've been sober 2 years now. And she was getting her birthday cake along with a former peer who was now getting her 17th cake. And she felt so awful, so degraded and lost, and she was telling me how terrible it was that she had only two and this other one had 17. And I said, you've missed the point of the program if you're still thinking like that. Because I knew, many of you perhaps did too, Jack Bailey, the Queen for a Day. I knew him sober almost 30 years, I guess. And he died sober. He died sober. And his wife, second wife, after his first wife died, his second wife was on the program. I introduced her to him. And they had a good, happy relationship. But after he passed away, she somehow lost it, and she got to drinking. And she died drunk. Now, the point of the story, I told my friend, is that one died sober, the other died drunk, but the thing that they have in common, the significant thing, is that they are dead. They are dead. You and this woman may have different lengths of sobriety, but you and she are alive. And that's what it's about, this awareness, this consciousness of existence. See, why are we so hard on ourselves? Why are we so hard on anyone when we're here such a brief time? We're like bubbles that come up through the champagne, pop and are gone. In the wink of a celestial eye, everybody in this room will be dead. And yet we go around thwarting ourselves, ruining ourselves, depriving ourselves by what will they think, what shall I do? This is the time to live. It really is. In the grave, we're not going to raise our hands and smite our enemies. The tomb is a very pacific place. What does the poet say? The grave, it is a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. If you've got any fighting to do, if you've got any loving to do, if you've got any living to do, this is the time to do it, without chemical courage. See, I think I have done everything that I ever fantasized about sober. Because if AA deprived you of the opportunity of living, of experiencing, you'd have to get drunk. Our book doesn't disapprove of anything. It says try it. That way it doesn't even disapprove of drinking, as the portion that was read said. If you think you can, go back to social drinking, well, give it a whirl. Our hats will be off to you. Not true. I've had my hat off standing by the grave of quite a few of them. Boy, you can But this is about living. And I got reminded me of it because a fellow was asking me, why do you seem so enthusiastic about your program, and why is your program better than mine? I said, I really don't think it is. It's just that I do things. I want to try it. I said, have you learned to fly an airplane since you've been sober? I said, no. But I did. Went out to an old anachronistic flight school, took 3 hours of training, and soloed. Rented a plane that weekend, flew to San Francisco. It didn't have any instruments. I didn't know anything about navigation. I just drove over Highway 101. Ha, 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 ha. Took my first free-fall parachute jump just before I became a grandfather about 10 or 15 years ago. When scuba diving, I know you're supposed to train. They have classes where you put on those snorkels and weird things and practice. I can't take time for that. I'm a Class A personality. You hum a couple of bars, I pick it up. I put the stuff off, jumped off of Catalina Island, swimming around down Seaweed City, gorgeous down there, ran out of air. I put my higher power to the test. I want you to know that. See, but that's the nice thing. You have a complete scapegoat. I haven't made a mistake in decades. Not the slightest faux pas. No deviation from the path of valor has been mine. On the other hand, God has seen fit to do through me some of the dumbest, most petty, lurid, ludicrous, self-centered things you could imagine. But if it gives him pleasure to make me look like a horse's ass, who are you to criticize? Some people get up here and say what they tell you is their own opinion. That's not true with me. I took the third step. What I tell you is the word of God, and you better listen up. The only thing is, he keeps seeing me look like a fool. No, but the thing is, really, you can live when you're not, in that sense, responsible. I got through the male menopause racing motorcycles with Steve McQueen out in the desert. You know, the only copy of the big book they used to see out around Mojave. I couldn't have done that drinking. I had to be dignified, lest you think the booze was getting to me. Now I can do anything. I celebrated my 60th birthday by running the Los Angeles Marathon. I smoked, as I mentioned, 2 to 3 packs of Camels for 35 years, so it gave me emphysema. I don't give up in a hurry. And when you have to choose between smoking and breathing, it isn't quite as difficult as it may sound. You get down on your knees and bark like a dog for a week, but other than that, nothing. But I had done so much damage, they told me to get into running. Now, all of my life, I have seen runners, usually old men with gnarled, knobby knees like tree roots, and sweatbands grunting highways. And I used to look at them and think, poor pathetic devils, if it should ever come to that. A fanatic is anybody who's doing something a week before I start. No, I'm one of them, man. They started this running craze about 10 years ago, right in my neighborhood. People were running, right in my neighborhood, hairy people, usually. And I would look at them and think, oh, God, I hope they don't steal something. And now I'm absolutely amazed at the distinguished ladies and gentlemen you can meet in the morning in their underwear out on the boulevard. But when I started, I couldn't go half a block, my lungs being what they were. But I kept it up, and I'd jog a half a block and wheeze and then walk a little bit, and I kept it up, and finally I got up to 2 miles. And I was leaving to go to a meeting someplace and caught myself as I went out of the house skipping. Skip, 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 skip. Instantly I stopped, of course. I thought, God, I hope the neighbors did not see that. I didn't skip as a boy. I've been called Mr. Gates since I was 13. My intimates call me Your Honor. And I thought, what's wrong here? And I realized what was wrong was that I had made that run a couple, 20, 30 minutes before, and it had hurt and been painful, but now I was getting a reward. The oxygen was pumping, the endorphins, which are a morphine-like substance, were loose in the brain. It's the only way you can get high and keep your seniority. And I thought, my, no one had ever told me this. They had told me it was good for me, which I construed as a threat. No one had told me it would make me feel good. They didn't know how to communicate. Well, if 2 miles will make you feel good within 6 months, I was up, how about 4, 8, 16? I was running half marathons before the year was out. I had stress fractures, both feet, bursitis of the hip, my back gave out. I didn't have a moment free from pain after I got healthy. But the body does rebuild and it heals. And as I say, I ran that L.A. Marathon. It was on my 60th birthday. And that's 26 miles. Well, as I was telling Bill, if you were to witness my locomotion, you might not be charitable enough to describe it as running. You might call it trudging or a survival shuffle of some sort. My wife and I, we run together, and if we explain to people that you can tell what we're doing by looking at our arms. See, if our arms go like this, we are walking. If they go like this, we are running. The speed is identical in both instances. Okay, but the amazing thing is that in every race we've been in, we've won. Isn't that amazing? Despite our condition. I don't mean we came in first. I have no idea what goes on with the fanatics up in the front of the pack. But back in the rear where the spiritual ones gather, there are categories by age, by sex, by occupation even. We have continued to refine ours down until we are the only ones that are in them. Because this program has taught me that is the way life is. There is no one else in my category. There is no one else in your category. We're not competing against each other. We're not in the same category. Each of us is working on ourselves. If you bear the game, you play. You bear the pain, you play the game, you finish the race, you're a winner. And it's just as true in life as in those runs. See, but all of this thing are things that I'm now able to do. But you will have moments of disaster. As I say, I promised a newcomer I wouldn't miss that. You do. My life just went to pieces here about 8-10 years ago. I don't know how long ago it was now. Everything I thought was stabilized just went out the window. And I found myself rearing a teenage son who, all my other kids were grown and off producing grandchildren. This little one was still there. And I had to raise him now. And I'd like to tell you, as a result of our wonderful program, he and I could communicate one-to-one. But any man who says he communicates one-to-one with his pubescent son lies about other things as well. You know, of course I didn't communicate with him. They have no command of the language. They can't communicate on any subject. They're going through the agonies of the damned, you know. That adolescence is a form of insanity. And they get a pimple, they're built like Greek gods, and their life is ruined. Oh, you know. The girls, they used to come home and, that boy, what's wrong? He looked at me. What do you mean he looked at you? How did he look at you? Funny. What do you mean funny? Funny for junior, lord, lead, but how am I kind of funny? Funny, funny, you know, they're dying and they have no form of speech. They go into their room, you know, where they have those records that they put those primordial grunts and amplified them. So naturally, he and I didn't communicate. He lived in the front of the house. I lived in the rear. The only time I saw him, I used to throw money out in the hall. And many times. But he and I both survived, and he's off in college now, and he's doing all right, apparently. And after a few years of our batching together, a young woman on this program, 19 years of sobriety, I don't monkey with newcomers, but she came on the program very, very young, and she came into our household, and we've been married now 6 years, and she seems to like me, and that's a wonderful thing. She doesn't even object to old age creeping on her at night, either. And it's been very good. My job had gone to pieces around that same period I mentioned this. My low ebb, and it's improved now, because jobs are very important to everyone. At the lowest point in my life, I think about 25 or so years ago, I went into a large law firm trying to get a job, and I'd been in around AA, as I mentioned, and I wanted them to love me. not for my own sake, I'd outgrown the need for human approval. No, I wanted them to love me to the glory of your name so I could get a job. And I told the guy a few funny little stories. I hadn't yet learned that you can't tell your stories to the non-alcoholic as sources of innocent merriment. And I told this guy a few light ones. I don't mean boffo. You know, I told him about the time I was drunk and threw my mother-in-law down the steps and being intoxicated till after and got a hernia, you know, something like that. And he didn't laugh. He didn't giggle a jig, titter a tit. He just kind of stared at me. And I thought, well, I guess I'm being too subtle. So I told him about the time I was in 4-point restraint and he vomited straight up. And that got a reaction. But I could see I wasn't getting home to him, so finally I said, now look, I'm not asking you to recommend me. And he said, recommend you? Recommend you? I wouldn't offer your name for consideration. No attorney in the history of this nation has ever done the things that you've done or had happen to him, the things that have happened to you. I suggest you forget the law, go into the countryside, try to regain your health and innocent labor. If there were members of this firm walk into a courtroom, they represent strength in the face of adversity, integrity, honor, reliability. Send you to represent us? Huh, never. Boy, I was crushed. I had not expected that. Nothing in my experience had led me to expect that kind of reaction. I wanted to slither like a serpent on my belly right across the floor out under the door to the nearest bar to drown the shame of that in the bottomless bottle like I always did. But I thought, by gosh, if I do that, he'll be right. He'll be absolutely right. I can't take it, and I won't give him the satisfaction. So I went out to the old 6300 Club, drank coffee at him. 10 years later, that guy flipped out. He took a check protector and one of the secretaries and ran to Paris. I mean, he disgraced the law firm, the legal profession. He disgraced his family, the city of Pasadena. It was one of the most beautiful displays of pyrotechnic misbehavior I've ever seen in my life, and he did it cold sober. And about 5 years ago, the governor of our state called me and told me he was going to appoint me to the appellate bench. As far as I know, the highest judicial office held by a sober alcoholic. In our state, at least. You know what happens now when I enter a courtroom and members of that law firm are there? They stand up. And they remain standing until I tell them they can be seated. All power to the powerless. And yet I haven't changed all that much. I don't drink anymore, which is, of course, the greatest change that can occur in an alcoholic's life. I've learned to laugh at myself, which is something you don't do or cause you to miss the greatest joke in your own generation. But other than that, I really have not changed that much. I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. And it leads to bizarre things, occasionally. But it leads to beautiful things. I want to get off here trying to find some kind of a rising note of hope. I heard somebody over here say, I think he died drunk. I'll tell you this, and then I'll get off. My wife and I went over to England a year ago, and we were on a study of the English judicial system, and we went into the English courts, and we went out to one of the Snaresbrook Crown Courts just outside of London, and they assigned two of us to each court. And because I was the highest ranking of our judges, I went into one where a high court judge happened to be sitting on circuit. Now, in England, the high court judges are lords. They're made peers of the realm. They are lords. They're knighted. And so this fellow said to us, my wife, by the way, went back to law school and passed the bar on the program. And so he said to us, would you like to take the bench with me? We said, well, certainly, it'd be a great honor. And he said, well, you'll excuse me while I don my raiment. And he said, you may find it a trifle ostentatious. You know, that underplaint the British have. He put on a robe you wouldn't believe. These high court judges, they don't wear the humble, sincere black that we do. He had on red velvet, crimson velvet robe. It had ermine running from the collar to the elbow, ermine around the from the cuff to the elbow and arm and around the collar. He had on the full white wig, not the little freshman dink, but the full white wig that comes all the way down, you know, and buckles and sashes, and I couldn't believe it. We walked onto the bench. We looked like a moving Christmas tree. I mean, he was red and white, and I was just green with envy. But we got into that courtroom, and this might not mean anything to those of you who never loved the Lord of the angel of the law, as they say, but to sit on the bench in an English courtroom, looking out at the sword in the back and the black robe barristers with their little white things, yes, my lord, no, my lord, to put it to you, my lord, you know, and to be sitting up there. It's unbelievable. Over in the dock, it happened to be a criminal case, was the defendant. You know, he was on trial, charged with aggravated assault. Now, 30 years ago, to the very month, maybe to the day, I don't know, but 30 years ago, I was standing in an American courtroom in handcuffs, charged with aggravated assault. Now, how can you go from the dock to the bench? How can you go from the lockup, from the pit? I sit on the Supreme Court in our state sometimes. I mean, how can that happen? If you were to put that on a soap opera, they would laugh you off the air as ridiculous. It is a sort of a miracle, however, meaning contrary to human experience, that is commonplace in AA. Everyone who stays sober is going to know a trip, not that particular one, because we're not competing with each other, we're not in the same race. But you're going to know something from there, from darkness to light, the same way. But I don't know how that happens. But I know how you go back, how you can go from the bench to the dock. You simply take the first drink. Thank you.